This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, some positive news on the opioid front. According to a recently released data set, prescriptions for opioid painkillers dropped significantly last year, declining by more than 10% in 2017.
Well, it's a really interesting and dramatic, really, shift in clinical practice to see this retreat from previous prescribing habits. Not only were fewer prescriptions written overall, but the number of first-time opioid prescriptions dropped by around 9%. That's such an important tactic to prevent future opioid use disorders. And I have to wonder, Mark, is that also consumers saying, no way, I've heard too much about these and don't want them?
And we should note that this comes on the heels of a policy directive 2 years ago from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, which issued much more stringent guidelines for opioid prescribing. It seems to have had an impact, Margaret.
And of course, that's really how the crisis began. Certainly well-meaning clinicians who were just seeking to alleviate pain, help their patients manage their pain. So these guidelines and this very actionable data are critically important tools to get a handle on this public health crisis or any public health crisis, but especially one that is as widespread and as deadly as this one has been.
Speaking of actionable data, that leads us to our guest today. Dr. Ashish Jha is professor of medicine and global health at Harvard Medical School. He just released a comprehensive analysis of American healthcare costs and found some interesting patterns and revelations in the data that confirm some notions about why American healthcare costs so much more than other countries.
He is also going to talk with us a little bit about the shocking lack of relevant data and easily accessible data to be able to effectively study and analyze the cost drivers in American healthcare. So really looking forward to hearing his insights, Mark.
And we're also looking forward to Lori Robertson, the managing editor of FactCheck.org, is always on the hunt for misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain. But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com or iTunes.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll get to our interview with Dr. Ashish Jha in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. The president's pick to replace fired VA Secretary Dr. David Shulkin is getting some pushback from the Senate. The Senate Veterans Affairs Committee is holding up the nomination, saying some new information has come to light, including the nominee presiding over a, quote, hostile work environment at the White House and overprescribing drugs. Members of both sides of the aisle concerned about these new revelations. That scope they're using to peer into your esophagus, chances are pretty good it's contaminated. In the wake of the rise of antibiotic-resistant hospital-acquired infections, infection control has become a top priority and safety concern. But a study of reusable scopes in several major hospitals showed 71% of them were contaminated with some form of bacteria. The study, published in the American Journal of Infection Control, found the presence of bacteria not just in the bulk of endoscopes, but scopes used for lung and kidney procedures, as well as colonoscopies. The researchers observed some sloppy handling and lack of adherence to disinfecting protocols throughout the study. And donated livers are precious and hard to come by for transplants. Currently, roughly 17,000 Americans are on a waiting list for a deceased person's liver. The average wait time can be more than 321 days. And then there's the transport. The usual mode of liver transport was a typical Coleman-like cooler and a pack of ice. But now experts feel that delivery mode is not optimal. Study of a new transport method in a carrier designed to mimic the body temperature and function, keeping the organs, quote, breathing, actually yielded two positive results. The organ stayed healthier for a longer period of time, and the process allowed previously inferior livers to be rendered transplant worthy. A similar transport method has already been approved for transporting donated lungs. This is promising news for those in the agonizing wait for a donated liver. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention would like you to eat more fruits and vegetables, but the CDC is saying stay clear of romaine lettuce for the moment. E. coli has been found in a widespread sample of romaine lettuce heads across the country, and they're erring on the side of caution, asking all romaine lettuce to be thrown out for the time being. The tainted romaine comes from Arizona and has sickened at least 50 people in a number of states. More than 30 have been hospitalized. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. Ashish Jha, professor of medicine and global health at Harvard Medical School and senior associate dean for research translation and global strategy at Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. He's also director of the Harvard Global Health Institute. Dr. Jha has conducted extensive research on how to improve quality and cost in the healthcare system. He's a member of the Institute of Medicine at the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine. He earned his medical degree from Harvard Medical School, trained in internal medicine at UC San Francisco. He completed his training at Brigham and Women's Hospital and received his master's in public health from Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. Dr. Jha, welcome back to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, you know, I think it's axiomatic for most people that when you say the American healthcare system, they say it's the most expensive in the world. But you recently released a detailed report produced in part with data from the Commonwealth Fund that's getting a lot of attention. You compared health expenditures here in the United States to 10 other industrialized nations, and some of what you found may be a little surprising to those who have specific ideas of what's behind that high price tag. And I'm wondering if you could share with our listeners what you set out to achieve with this study and what you found most surprising.
So look, everybody knows American healthcare about twice as expensive as other high-income countries. There are lots of theories about why that is. And one of the things I've found over the years is when we lack data on a topic, then stories and theories really end up kind of dominating the public scene. And if we're going to make progress on spending in America, we have to actually understand in detail what's behind our cost problem. And there'd been some really good work back in the late 90s, early 2000s. One study by Uwe Reinhardt and Jerry Anderson that was entitled It's the Prices, Stupid. And the idea behind that paper was that it was really prices in healthcare that were the drivers and not a lot of the other theories that have come out. And, you know, it's the international comparisons have been hard because we haven't really had comparable data. And without comparable data, it's very hard to compare apples to apples. And the good news is in the last 5-7 years, there have been a lot of efforts to put together information that really puts countries on an equal footing and says, hey, let's understand what's going on between these different health systems.
Well, Dr. Jha, thank you for reminding us all about the late Dr. Uwe Reinhardt, who's also been a guest on the show. And we have always remembered that observation that it's the price is stupid, or the yeah. question about the high cost. But we really are curious, as you have parsed out the many hidden costs that go into healthcare, what did you find? You know, some of it perhaps surprising, some of it predictable when we come to those details of the hidden costs.
Yeah. So if you look at American healthcare and you compare it to these 10 other countries, and these 10 other countries, by the way, are all among the highest income countries, the sort of Sweden's and Japan's and Denmark's, UK, Canada. What we find is a couple of things. The most predictable finding is our administrative costs are about 2 to 3 times higher than almost any other country. We're just a very complex nation in our health system. There's some common theories that we have about American healthcare, how it differs. One of them is people often say, I even used to say, that we're very specialty driven. Other high-income countries, the European countries, are very primary care focused. It turns out, not so much. Like when you look at the proportion of doctors in America that are primary care, it's about average across all these countries. We're really not an outlier on primary care. Another very commonly held belief has been that we have this problem with overutilization, that we just do too much stuff to people. People get spend too much time in hospitals. People spend too much time getting major surgeries. And that's really what's driving all the spending in American healthcare. Again, it turns out we use hospitals a little bit less than average compared to these other countries. We go to the doctor a little less often. You know, we do more MRIs and CTs. We have more knee replacements, but we have fewer hip replacements. So it turns out, in my mind, we're above average on a few utilizations, below average on a few others, and on average, you know, we're pretty average. And so utilization, primary care, inpatient, outpatient spending, a lot of these basic theories that we've had, turn out none of those are all that different between America and Europe. The big difference, the thing that really drives the spending difference, is prices. And again, in some ways, it comes back to Uwe, who was one of my heroes and has, you know, taught us more about healthcare than maybe anybody else. It really turns out that the same medicine in America costs three times as much as the medicine in France. The same MRI in America costs two, three, four times as much as an MRI in Switzerland. It's not about utilization. It's not about primary care. It's really about how much we pay for everything.
Well, speaking of sort of European countries in primary care, we just had Dr. Charles Alessi on as a guest, the senior advisor for Public Health England, who talked about UK's ability to provide access to primary care for all citizens without the barriers of having to pay for services at the point of care. And obviously no disincentives for consumers to access high value preventative primary care services in England. I wonder if you could give us some examples of some of the other health systems you studied and how their delivery system factored into lower costs but better outcomes. What did you find?
So, yes, we looked at, you know, Sweden and Denmark, Japan, Canada, UK, very high functioning, high income countries. One of the big points is that there is no European health system. I mean, Europe, it turns out, is not a country. And Switzerland looks very different from the UK, which looks very different from France. So it isn't like there is a single European formula for primary care. It's true that there's no payment at the point of service for primary care in the UK. You know, things look different in Switzerland. It's true that there are a lot of primary care physicians in Denmark. Sweden has far fewer primary care physicians. So it's really interesting because what it tells us is that every country arrives at its own solution for providing good care, for covering everybody. And if America is going to make progress, it's not going to make progress by copying Germany or France or England. It's going to make progress by coming up with a uniquely American solution.
Well, Dr. Jha, we've also been following and appreciating your work on analyzing the effectiveness of some of the new payment models that have emerged in recent years, primarily since the Affordable Care Act was passed. So we now have a growing number of accountable care organizations, and interestingly, they're across the commercial world, the Medicare world, and even the Medicaid world. And those organizations are collecting data on cost savings and improved outcomes, and hopefully on the patient experience as well. But you've commented that so far, while there may be some added efficiencies, these haven't really moved the needle on cost savings or customer experience. We're really curious to hear your thoughts about which of the alternative payment models you think hold the most promise, and are there specific innovations in those models that you think would really sort of advance progress further?
Look, I am a big believer in alternative payment models, but one of the things I like to tell people it is that it's a faith-based initiative. We do not have much evidence that they work or do very much. So I think we have to be circumspect about how much we know and how enthusiastic we should be. It's been 8 years since the passage of the Affordable Care Act. Where are we in terms of evidence, and what do we know about the status of these things? I would say, one, the overwhelming evidence is that value-based payments, pay for performance, giving bonuses and penalties, that has been a complete failure. It just has not worked. It has not moved the needle. Almost all the evidence says that it has probably hurt safety net providers by taking money away from them and giving it to more wealthy institutions. But other than that, it has not improved quality for almost anybody. You know, one of the key things about policy is if you try something with good intentions and it doesn't work, you got to stop. And we have a very hard time in our country stopping policies that are not working. And I think it's high time. I mean, to stop the pay for performance stuff. You know, I don't know how much longer you want to give it, but we've had a decade of experience. On ACOs and bundle payments, I am more hopeful, but that hope is not based on a whole lot of very strong data. On ACOs, the net-net is that they probably have saved us a little bit of money, somewhere around 1 or 2% lower spending than would have been otherwise. So not that they have reduced spending by 1 or 2%, but it has grown about 1 to 2% more slowly than comparable organizations that were not part of ACOs. So not a home run, but, you know, it's a little bit, and I'll take it. Quality, again, is sort of a similar story, maybe marginal improvement in outcomes, but you really have to stare at the data in the right way to convince yourself that these things are creating those kinds of benefits. Bundle payment is a bit in the same story. Maybe the savings are a little bit bigger. No impact on quality as far as I can see it. And so I think going back to just doing nothing is not a good solution. And what we need to do is keep experimenting with these models. Try bundles with more things. Try longer bundles. With ACOs, right now it's been pretty much one-sided, you know, risk. Maybe once we move organizations into two-sided risk, we'll see more movement. Mm-hmm. My general take is, one is we got to experiment, and when experiments don't work, we got to stop.
We're speaking today with Dr. Ashish Jha, a professor of medicine and global health at Harvard Medical School and senior associate dean for research translation and global strategy at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. You know, I was thinking as you were talking about, there's no country known as Europe. We had David Gergen on the show, and not dissimilar to you, he said, we really need to find an American health solution. And I'm wondering if there's really a country called America, because there are really 50 states, right? There are 50 Medicaid programs, there are 50 health insurance commissioners. And so I'd be interested in sort of how we work through all that. And then the other thing you were talking about is prices. And we had Stephen Brill on the show. You can't get to prices. Prices are high, but I can't understand them. How do we sort of address that in this larger context of finding this American solution?
Yeah. Here's how I think about it. It reminds us that international comparisons have to be done with a little bit more humility, including our international comparison. Mm-hmm. Look, people love talking about Finland and how great Finland is. Finland is great, by the way. It's got a great health system. It's a great country. Finland is 20% smaller than Massachusetts. And to compare Finland to America doesn't actually make
any
sense. You know, what's interesting is in our paper, we showed some data looking at, for instance, Minnesota. Turns out Minnesota's health spending, and more importantly, health outcomes look exactly like Sweden. On spending, it's still higher than Sweden, but on health outcomes, Minnesota is Sweden. So my take on this is, you know, we have Massachusetts and Hawaii, but we also have Mississippi and Alabama and places that have much higher rates of poverty. So if we're going to think about America as a country, which I would like to, we have to first begin by understanding its complexities and saying that the right comparison is Denmark, as Bernie Sanders likes to say, but the right comparison may in fact be Europe, because Europe is about the size of America and has a diversity. Second point, you know, one of the things we talk about is how do we get to universal coverage in America? Well, Massachusetts is at about 98, 99% coverage. I mean, we're close. As a nation, we're at 90%. That's not bad. Mm-hmm. We've got to figure out a strategy for getting the other 10%. The Affordable Care Act tried to do that. Medicaid expansion, the insurance exchanges. We can get to an American solution on this. Letting states have a good amount of flexibility for how they get to full coverage, but basically demanding that states figure out how to get to universal coverage within their own population. And some states will do it through Medicaid, others will push on exchanges. On the issue of prices, I think about prices in the following way, which is there are two ways that people know how to control prices. One is really efficient markets, lots of competition, so that if you charge high prices, your consumers will go elsewhere. It's got to have transparency and openness and all of that. The second approach, of course, is a very strong price setter that says, we're spending only $300 on an MRI. You want to charge $1,000? You can. Well, you're going to get $300 and not a penny more. We have figured out how to do the worst of both worlds. We have, in Medicare, a very weak price setter that's politically constrained from dealing with prices. And most markets have a lot of market power in providers who can charge very high prices. If you're on the left, you're going to want to give Medicare more negotiating power. I'm fine with that. If you're on the right, you're going to want to have more efficient markets, more competition. I'm fine with that. But doing neither, which is what we're doing now, and thinking that ACOs and bundle payments will somehow solve our cost problem, it's not going to get us there.
Well, Dr. Zha, let's talk about the consumer, right? Or we can call them the patients.
Yep.
Yes, we've gotten to historic low rates of uninsured, but the reality seems to be that consumers are facing much higher copays and much higher out-of-pocket costs, which perhaps causes them to think twice before utilizing some healthcare services.
Yep.
When you look at this issue, what role is consumer spending playing in the overall health costs as people have to really make decisions with their pocketbook about what they're going to actually spend money on? What hope might there be for a better focus on public health and primary prevention?
No doubt. We've gotten a lot more people covered, but the cost of that coverage has been, you know, 60 million Americans now have a relatively high deductible health plan. And if you're wealthy, it's no big deal. But for average Americans, it's a real financial burden. What we know, the data is very clear, that when you go into a high deductible health plan, you have large copays, large deductibles. What happens is you consume fewer healthcare services. Now, of course, that's the whole goal, right? The data says that you consume less of unnecessary stuff. That's good. You also consume less of necessary stuff. You don't go to the doctor on something you really ought to go to the doctor for. So people are not able to make rational choices when they face very high deductibles. And I actually think it's because it's hard to make those decisions. I put my family in a high deductible health plan because I actually wanted to experience what it was like. And of course, as a physician and you know, above average income, I found it a struggle. I made some really bad decisions. Look, we are doing it halfway where we're really kind of picking the worst of both worlds. Because if you put people in a high deductible health plan, can it work to improve quality and improve spending? It can, but it needs a few other things. It needs real price transparency. It needs the opportunity for other low-cost providers to come into the market. And making me pay for it out of pocket, all it does is it shifts the bill to me instead of the insurance company. So what we need to have is a lot more innovation and competition in the marketplace if we're going to give high deductible health plans an experiment, a chance to work. Otherwise, all we've done is just made life harder for middle-income Americans without really fixing the underlying problem.
You know, I love your quote that an ounce of data is worth 1,000 pounds of opinion. I think it's going to be right up there with Mark Twain's. There are three types of lies, damn lies, and statistics. But you say research has been and continues to be hamstrung by the lack of truly actionable data. Fundamental costs such as provider salary, expensive diagnostic machinery, the amount of money being spent on low value care. You say that we have a treasure trove of Medicare data that could provide quite useful information to us. And I thought our friend Todd Park had liberated all of that data. And I'm wondering if you could talk about the lack of access to actionable data and why this access is so important to moving the needle in the American healthcare system.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a worldview thing. I mean, I look at the last 100 years of human history and I think, boy, we have massive progress. How have we made so much progress in the last 100 years? You know, if you think about almost all the big gains that have come from research, from public health, from healthcare discoveries. And so I just have this very strongly held belief that if we can study questions, use real data, real evidence, we can make progress on almost any topic in front of us. And so then when we go to the American healthcare system, right, which is $3+ trillion, it's sucking money away from education and social services, companies and households. If I say, okay, I want to figure out how to make this health system more efficient, I can come up with theories. But if we're going to use evidence, which I believe is the only way we're actually going to make progress, we need data. And Todd and Park and others have been evangelicals on this. But here's the reality on the ground. In 2018, I, as a researcher, every year that I want Medicare data to answer any set of questions like, are ACOs saving money? I have to shell out about $150,000 a year. That's how much money I have to spend. I have to pay Medicare to give me a standard cut of data. And so guess what? There are only 5 or 7 research groups in the country that actually are able to afford getting this kind of data every year. Medicare should give these data away for free. Get 100 research groups working on this, of 1,000 research groups. And what you'll get is a lot more interesting evidence, a lot more data, and a lot more learning about how we're going to improve healthcare. The approach right now where basically only a small number of groups can do this because the data is so hard to get, I'm still waiting for 2016 data. I haven't received the 2016 data yet. Imagine if the Fed made interest rate policy based on data from 2 years ago. No, like they're making it based on job market data from last week. I'm sorry, with all due respect to folks who have been on this, and I appreciate what they've been trying to do, we have not liberated the data, not anywhere close.
Well, we want to throw our support behind the liberation forces for that Medicare data, so we'll thank you for making that point. We've been speaking today with Dr. Ashish Jha, Professor of Medicine and Global Health at Harvard Medical School and Senior Associate Dean for Research, Translation, and Global Strategy at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. You can learn more about this study and Dr. Jha's work by going to hsph.harvard.edu/ashish.jha, or you can follow him on Twitter at Ashish K. Jha. Dr. Jha, thank you so much for your body of very important work and for joining us again on Conversations on Healthcare.
I always enjoy chatting with you guys. Thank you.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
This week, we'll turn to the public health issue of guns. Our readers asked us if the Obama administration had legalized bump stocks for semi-automatic rifles, as President Trump claimed in a tweet. Well, no federal law explicitly addresses bump stocks. The Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives ruled 10 times between 2008 and 2017 that certain models could not be prohibited under existing gun laws. A bump stock is a device that can be attached to the rear of a semi-automatic rifle to make it shoot almost as fast as a fully automatic weapon. The devices became part of the gun debate in October after 64-year-old Stephen Paddock used AR-style rifles affixed with bump stocks to shoot people attending an outdoor concert in Las Vegas, killing more than 50 people. At issue is whether the devices meet the definition of machine gun under federal firearm laws, which have prohibited the transfer and possession of a machine gun since 1986. Federal law defines a machine gun as a weapon that, quote, is designed to shoot automatically more than one shot. It's true that under Obama, the ATF, an agency within the Justice Department, ruled that it could not prevent the use of certain models of bump stocks. But it also made a similar ruling in April 2017 under the Trump administration. Some bump stocks have been deemed illegal, such as the Atkins Accelerator in a 2006 ruling, because it was determined to meet the single pull of the trigger definition of a machine gun. The ATF in late March proposed a rule to clarify that a machine gun does include bump stock type devices. Gun rights groups and advocates, however, have said that any final rule could be challenged in court. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Soaring prescription drug prices have been taking a toll on American health consumers. But until now, most didn't understand how those prices were set. Many Americans have resorted to purchasing prescriptions online, often illegally or overseas. These solutions come with their own risk. So an enterprising pair of brothers have created their own solution. Matthew and Jeffrey Chaikin founded Blink Health, a free online destination that links patients with prescription sources that can be up to 90% cheaper than what's found on the traditional market.
You go to blinkhealth.com, you look up the name of your medication. The price you see there is the price you get at over 60,000 pharmacies nationwide. You pay for it online. We provide you with what we call a digital Blink pharmacy card. You show that card to the pharmacist and your medication rings up as $0.
Co-founder Jeffrey Chaykin to CBS News recently, they negotiated prices directly with drug manufacturers.
We actually have contracts with every single pharmacy in the United States. What's important for consumers is that when they go to blank, there's one price that they're going to see. They'll get that price no matter which pharmacy they go to.
The element that makes it work so well is customers can purchase the drugs online, but still pick them up at their trusted local pharmacy. Since Blink launched last year, users have saved millions of dollars on prescriptions, and a majority of those prescriptions are filled for $10 or less. Blink, an online site for purchasing prescription drugs, offering consumers an option to safely fill prescriptions at a far more competitive price than the going rate, allowing them to stay healthy and save significant money at the same time. Now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.